Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 18th, 2008. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. But this week, Chris Colby from Brew Your Own Magazine walks us through the process of making a sour mash. Whether you're doing some pH correction or making a sour beer, Chris says sour mashing is an easily done technique. Well, if you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through both basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. I want to start off by saying that I hope everybody who was in the path of Ike is safe and recovering. I know that there are a lot of homebrewers in the Houston area who listen to the show, and I've also heard from listeners as far north as Ohio who were affected by that storm. And as I said, I hope that all of you and your families are well and that you'll be able to take care of any, you know, property damage that you may have had through that storm. We got a little taste of what went on down south of us when Ike roared through our part of the world, northwest Arkansas. The sustained winds were in the mid-30s mile per hour, with gusts of over 50 miles per hour. You know, that's pretty strong, but just a fraction of the power that hit Houston and Galveston. But it was enough to knock over some trees around here, and it also blew the bird poop guards off my hop trellises. So it was enough to make us nervous for a couple of hours. So it's interesting what sustained winds can do to your nerves, even at that level. So I can't imagine what you guys went through down there. So, again, I hope that things return to normal very soon. I got a note from the organizers of the Australian National Homebrewing Conference on a lighter note. They were reminding me that the Australian National Homebrewing Conference is coming up Thursday, October 23rd. Through Saturday, October 25th. That's going to go on in Melbourne. We'll have more information as time goes on, but in the meantime, you can find out more at anhc.com.au. So check that out. If you are going to be down there, that's anhc.com.au. And again, as we get a little closer, we'll have more information about that. I got a note from Kai Troister, who you heard talk about attenuation in last week's show. As you'd expect, Kai listened to the interview very attentively, and he found a place where he misspoke. Kai says, "When I give the example about the Helles targeting an actual attenuation of 82 to 84%, if the limit of attenuation is 80%, I meant the target attenuation should be 78 to 76%. Obviously, the actual attenuation cannot be higher than the limit of attenuation if the latter was determined correctly and there is no other bug working in the beer." So I appreciate that, Kai. David from Montreal wrote a little while back. He says, "James, after listening to last week's podcast, French Press Hopping, and currently listening to some comments on it this week, I was wondering if you think that the issue that you had can be because the hops were packed too much in that French press, so extraction was not good enough. Just my thought on it. I may be wrong, but when I have heard you both packing it to be able to pull off the, or to put the full 1 ounce in there, that's what came to my mind." Well, David may have a good point, and I appreciate you writing in, David, and you're not the only one that wrote in about that. The 1 ounce of whole hops was packed in there pretty tight in the French press, so it may not have gotten much circulation of the wort through there, and there may not have been as much volume as needed to get some, you know, good dissolving of those hop flavors and aromas into that. However, I got to say, from a mechanical perspective, I prefer whole hops in the French press over pellets. Because I think I mentioned last week that I used a couple ounces of Willamette pellets in boosting the hoppiness of my pale ale, and it was tough to get a clean press of the pellets, especially after boiling them for a few minutes. That the hop material from the pellets broke down, and it just wanted to go around the seal of the plunger. So I don't know. I think I'll have to play with that some more to get a good balance of hop flavor and aroma and ease of using that French press. Roger watched the most recent Basic Brewing video episode where Steve and I roasted coffee in my vintage 1983 air popper, popcorn popper. Roger says, if you're handy, you can add a toggle switch to the popper that will shut off the heat but leave the fan running. He says the fan will do a better job of cooling than Steve and his silly colander. He says, just kidding, Steve. Just be sure the switch is rated high enough. Well, thanks, Roger. Unfortunately, I'm not very handy when it comes to wiring things, so I'll probably stick with the colander and the shaking. Much lower risk of electrocution in my hands. However, I know that there are listeners out there who can put that tip to good use and wire up the popcorn popper. Just be careful when you do it. I also want to say that David Matthews up at the Home Brewery in Fayetteville told me that that he watched us roast the coffee, and he said that we probably didn't get through the second crack when we roasted our coffee on the camera, and I think that Dave is probably right. But, you know, I really like the level of roast that we got on that particular roasting session. It's very mild and almost chocolatey, and it's not very bitter, which I think would be pretty good in like a vanilla porter with a little touch of bourbon or you know, some other whiskey. But that's the fun of roasting your own coffee. You can get to play with the amount of roasting that you want to get. Ron from Aurora, Illinois writes, I'm new to home brewing. I've brewed 3 different extract kits since mid-June, and my second batch, a nut brown ale, didn't turn out well. It started at 1046 specific gravity. After 3 weeks in the primary, it measured 1018 and stayed there for a week. It has spent 4 weeks in the bottle, and a small CO2 cloud does appear when a bottle is opened. However, the beer is flat, no head whatsoever, even if I try to create one with a pour. I have tasted it, and it's very sweet and, of course, flat. Is there anything to do to salvage this beer? Calling it beer may be a stretch. It would seem that I have bottled wort. Well, you haven't bottled wort. You've gotten some fermentation there, Ron, so don't panic. In fact, if we use what we learned from Kai last week, we can see that your apparent attenuation is around 61%, which normally I would say wasn't great. However, what I don't know is what was in your kit. First of all, some extracts don't ferment down very low, and if they've added some additional unfermentable sugars in there to get you know, the sweet style like a nut brown ale, then a finishing gravity of 1018 might not be far off. So I advised Ron to ask the homebrew shop where he bought the kit what they expected the original gravity and final gravity to be before writing the beer off. Also, as usual, I advised him to be patient on the carbonation. He's just got to make sure that the beer is in a nice warm place around fermentation temperature so that the yeast can work. And it will probably get more carbonated as time goes on. So with the added carbonation, that will add some sharpness to the beer that will take away some of that sweetness and add some balance. So, Ron, be patient and keep me posted. And if you have some additional advice for Ron or anybody that you hear me talk to, or if you want to contradict some of my advice, which is fine, I appreciate that too. Just drop me a line at james@basicbrewing.com or just use the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and I appreciate your doing that. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from and also check your email address so that I can get back to you. Well, now let's get on to our conversation with Chris Colby, editor of Brew Your Own Magazine, which we recorded this past Friday before Hurricane Ike rolled through. Chris lives down in Austin, which they expected to get hit by the storm, but it didn't. So when we talked to Chris, he was about to prepare for the worst, essentially. Well, Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Good morning, James.
And you're preparing for the Hurricane Ike down there as we speak. I'll be airing this next week, so, you know, the future people who will be listening to this, they'll know what happened to Austin, but now you're kind of in a waiting game.
Yeah, we're preparing to get some wind and rain here. If it comes this way, we're expected to have tropical storm strength winds and rain, and so I'll be filling a couple corny kegs with water tonight just in case.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's a good idea. Another reason to keg. You can prepare for natural disasters.
You have a propane burners if you're a, so you can cook.
There you go.
Being a home brewer makes you disaster proof.
Yeah, you can boil your water. If the municipal water supply goes out, you can. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're all ready to go, and you got beer.
Yeah, so. Most importantly.
Well, good luck. But as usual, I start talking about something that we're not supposed to be talking about. I called you up to talk about an article in this month's episode of Brew Your Own Magazine on sour mashing by Dave Green. And we've had requests for a show on sour mashing. So as usual, if I wait around long enough, you guys will do an article on it, and I'll just, I can just talk to you.
So it all works out.
Yeah. So you say that you've done sour mashing a couple times, and it's not that hard.
No, it's real easy. It's the only sort of hard part to it is just planning ahead to do it. And that's if you can plan ahead and do a yeast starter, you can certainly plan ahead and do a sour mash.
Now, what is sour mashing, and why would you want to do it?
The idea of sour mashing is you'll make a regular mash first, and then once it's converted, you'll stir in some more grains, crushed grains into it, usually dissolved in some water, to cool it down to right about 120. And the idea is that at this temperature, lactic acid bacteria, such as lactobacillus and pediococcus, grow quickly. And you basically turn the whole mash sour. And you can use it for a couple different reasons. If you're mashing a pale beer and your water's very soft, it doesn't have enough calcium to drive the pH down, you can add acid directly. And one way, you can add acid directly is, in the form of a sour mash. Mm. You can stir maybe 5%. Maybe creeping up to 10% of your, the total mash volume as a sour mash. And then, of course, secondarily, if you want to make a sour beer, you can make a sour mash and do it that way. A lot of the, traditional sour beers that we think of, like lambics or Berliner Weisses or whatever, those are soured in fermentation. Mm-hmm. But, as an experimental home brewer, you certainly can, come up with different ways to sour beers. And a lot of like Belgian wheat beers, if you make a small sour mash beforehand, mash it in, just enough, not enough to turn the beer into a lambic or whatever, but just enough to give it a little bit of a tart edge. It can be a real nice thing.
Huh. And there are other styles that we don't traditionally think of as being sour that would benefit from a little tang of sourness as well.
Yeah, you can take any style you want and, stir in, a little bit of a sour mash and see how it goes. Part of the sort of inspiration for this article was Dave Green, the guy who wrote it, works for BYO up in Vermont. And the Vermont pub and brewery where Greg Noonan works, they have four different beers right now that are made with a sour mash.
Huh.
So for some reason, Greg Noonan is just going crazy with the sour mashes. And Dave said to me, he's like, have we ever done an article? And I said, not for a while. And so he talked to Greg about it. And, so you can spice up any beer you want. I tend to think wheat beers, if you're going to do something like that, like a Belgian-y wheat kind of thing, works really well with a little, like a wit or a saison, sour it down just a little.
Yeah, that seems to make sense. I can picture a Belgian wit with just a little bit of sourness, you know, it's kind of a creamy style, and a little bit of sourness in there would give kind of a sour cream kind of feel to it. And that seems appealing to me. Dave says that in the article that he doesn't recommend hoppy beers being soured, but he says that that just may be his personal taste.
Yeah, I don't think hops really work well with sour, but, you know, like you say, some other people, you know, might have a palate that differs.
So what are the bugs that we're wanting to encourage? And there are some bugs that we don't want to encourage as well, right?
Yeah, basically what you want to do is set up a condition where the lactic acid bacteria can grow, lactobacillus and pediococcus. And there's just a whole slew of things you don't want growing in there. I mean, when we talk about, you know, bugs in beer, we usually talk about, you know, Brett and lactopedio, acetobacter, and, you know, there's four or five that get mentioned, but there's, you know, literally probably hundreds of things that could and would be growing in your sour mash if you did it wrong. You know, and brewing's not microbiology, so people only tend to identify the few things that, you know, are really matter. So yeah, you want to culture and, you know, encourage the lactic acid bacteria, and you want to try to, as much as you can, shut down on everything else to just make the sour mash just be, you know, have a clean, you know, clean sourness that's not affected by other off flavors.
Some of the bugs that, or a couple of the bugs that he mentions are Acetobacter or Clostridium.
Yeah.
And at least one of those sounds like something you need an ointment for. So it's not something that I would encourage in the beer off the cuff. But Acetobacter would give you kind of a vinegary taste.
Yeah, that's the same. That's the same one that's a wort spoiler. You know, if you're fermenting your beer and if the top is exposed to oxygen and it's contaminated with Acetobacter, you know, that'll grow on the top, make the vinegar smell. And same thing happens in the sour mash. If you leave the top exposed to oxygen, it will it can develop, you know, a sort of vinegar taint to it. There's an easy way to prevent that, though, and that's just, you know, most of the time when you make a sour mash, you do it in a small cooler. Either fill the, you know, absolutely, like, heaping to the rim and you know, mash the top on so there's no air in there. Or if you're not mashing enough to fill your whole little cooler, I use one of those little, I forget what they call it. It's like Coleman Personal 8 or whatever. You know, it holds like a six-pack of beer or something.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, small cooler. But even if you're not going to fill that, just take a sheet of, like, that cling wrap, you know, and just press it down across the top of the sour mash, and that'll, you know, do a pretty good job of excluding oxygen. You know, the only place it'll get in really is you know, around the edges.
Now he describes the effect of Clostridium as producing a mixture of rank locker room smell mixed with vomit.
Yeah. So,
that's not something you want on your beer label, I would think.
Yeah, you can, a sour mash that's gone wrong can go really, really wrong. It can get ugly. It's one of those things, if you set it up right, odds are it's going to go good, but it's very similar to lambic brewing, is that there's always a roll of the dice there. You know, you can have brewed lambics forever and been very successful, and, you know, every once in a while you just have a batch that just, you know, goes wrong, wrong, wrong.
So if you get a sour mash that is nasty, it's not something that you can fix by boiling it for an hour with the rest of your wort, right?
No, then you're just, you know, boiling your crappy smelling mash and having that smell be broadcast everywhere. Yeah, if the sour mash goes bad, you know, dump it out. Or, I mean, I've had sour mashes so bad I've been tempted to throw away the cooler.
No,
you know, just not deal with it. But you could fill a cooler with water afterwards, put some baking soda in it, and that'll take the smell out. But yeah. If you do a sour mash and it goes bad, just dump it.
And that's a good question. I mean, I have like a little 2-gallon Rubbermaid drinking water cooler that I use for, you know, doing like either partial mashes or little all grain experiments.
Mm-hmm. That'd be a great size.
Would it be good to do a sour mash in there? And like, for instance, you know, Vinny Chalurzo of Russian River keeps his, you know, all of his equipment that he uses with bugs, he keeps that separate from his straight beer stuff. Would it be safe to use something that you've used for a sour mash that's plastic? Would it be safe to use that for standard mashes later on?
Well, sure. I mean, for one thing, if you're using it for mashes later on, for like partial mashes, you're going to end up boiling the wort afterwards. So even if there was any residual contamination, that wouldn't be a problem because it's before the boil. And also you can, you know, when you're done with the sour mash, you'll be, you know, I've seen your videos. You keep a clean brewery, you know. You wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't use, you know, use one with, you know, grain chunks still stuck on the side and, you know, uncleaned, but, you know, wash it out with some hot, you know, some hot PBW or even some hot soapy water, and, you know, that should take care of it.
Plus, it takes a couple days for this to take effect anyway, so if you were to do a standard mash over, like, an hour, it's not like it's going to be sour at the end of that hour.
Right.
So, so when we're talking about doing a sour mash, we're not talking about doing a mash of the whole volume. And that's something that kind of surprised me. I thought if you do a sour mash, you're doing, you know, a whole sour mash. But this is just a percentage of what you want to put in your mash tun.
Yeah, you can make your entire mash sour. I know people who have tried doing Berliner Weisses that way, and I think the Kentucky Common or whatever the beer style that's supposedly you know, is a traditional sour beer, I think was supposed to be made with a full you know, the complete mash left to sour. But the way most people do it, and especially if you're just doing it for acidifying your mash or making a small amount of, you know, sour in the beer, is to take a small percentage of the total, what's going to be your total grain bill, you know, and start the sour mash a day or two early and have it be, you know, for just acidification, you know, maybe 5% of your total wort. And, you know, if you're going to try to add a little sour, you know, snap to your beer, maybe up to 20% of the total mash.
Just depending on taste, basically.
Sure. And, you know, if you're an experimental brewer and, you know, especially one that likes, you know, more sourness in your beer, you could, you know, you could try doing half and half or, you know, 75% sour mash or whatever. You know, there's, you know, every option's open to you. And, you know, certainly the two big variables in a sour mash are, you know, how big they are, you know, what percentage of your total mash they're going to take up, and how long they've been sour mashing. Because they get, you know, progressively more and more sour as time goes on.
So as far as equipment-wise is concerned, we'll need a little cooler. And then Dave also recommends having a pH meter as well.
That can help you. You know, you'll be able to tell what the pH is, and especially if you're using the mash for biological acidification, you know, then it's good to have. For if you're just brewing with it as, you know, to try to add a flavor, you know, you can just smell it and taste it and have that be your guide too.
So kind of a low-tech way, kind of using your senses rather than a piece of scientific equipment.
Yeah, you know, things like pH meters and, you know, we're lucky these days to have a lot of sort of scientific or technical equipment to help us measure things, but, you know, you're still making something that you're going to end up tasting. So I'm always a big advocate of, you know, using your sense of taste and smell as, you know, as a tool that you treat just as seriously as any pH meter or, you know, brewing spreadsheet or, you know, anything that spits out a number at you. Mm-hmm. You know, those are all great, but, you know, use them in conjunction with your senses, not as a, you know, replacement for them.
If the beer doesn't taste good, but it looks good on paper.
Yeah, that's no good.
So take us through the step-by-step. What do we do? We got to start a couple days early, but take us through. What's the process?
Yeah, you want to start a couple days early. The mash will, after a day, is going to be only very, very mildly sour. you know, usually that there's a considerable amount of, when you're dealing with, you know, the bugs or whatever, there's a considerable amount of variation in what can happen. But after a day, you know, you've got sort of a mildly sour mash. After 2 days, you got a, you know, nice, there'll be a serious sourness to it. And, you know, if you let it go 3 days, you know, you can potentially have, you know, very, very sour. As time goes on, of course, the probability that some problem flavor arises, it, you know, gets increased, especially if you're having trouble holding the temperature constant. So yeah, you decide how many days you're going to try it. You know, if I was going to try it for a first time, I might say, you know, take a 2 day mash just because your probability of working goes up. Although, you know, you're not developing quite the maximum amount of sour. And then you start by just doing a mash. You know, you just take crushed grains, you mash in at, you know, you can do it at basically any, you know, liquor to grist ratio that you want that's going to work. I've usually gone a little thick on mine. I don't know if there's any good reason for that, but it just seemed to me to work. So you mash it normally like you would, you know, hold it at 150 to 158 for, you know, at least 20 minutes, you know, just enough to get conversion. And then what you do is take some more crushed grain, mash in that crushed grain with like room temperature water or slightly colder water than that, and then just start stirring that into your sour mash until the temperature drops to right about 120. I don't think it's, you know, absolutely critical to hit, you know, that temperature on the nose, but cool the mash down to 120, and that's right in the zone where the lactic acid bacteria, particularly lactobacillus, tends to grow strongly. And then, you know, cover the top of it, either with the cling wrap or if your cooler is, you know, fold the rim, put that on and just put it somewhere where it's gonna, you know, ideally you'd like to have it hold at 120 degrees, with a small, you know, with a small mash though, that becomes, you know, more problematic because it's small in volume and it's gonna drop in temperature. But if you have, you know, if it's summer, you know, especially summer and you live somewhere where it's warm, you know, keep it outside where the sun is shining on it, you know, in the cooler, and you can probably hold it pretty close to where you want it for most of the time.
You have a couple of choices when inoculating this. You can go the store-bought way of actually purchasing the lactobacillus culture, or you can get it naturally by using more of your raw grain that you haven't used yet.
Yeah, you can, you know, Y Yeast and I think White Labs, I can't remember if they sell individual cultures. I know Y Yeast does. People have also tried it with yogurt starters, although I think that's a slightly different strain than the brewing strains that are usually used. And you can also just, I've done it by just, you know, stirring in the crushed grain, you know, during the malting process, the grain is wet, you know, and then, you know, it sprouts and it's let to dry and it, you know, there's all these different, you know, stages where it's, you know, it's underwater and then it's, you know, drying in the air or whatever. And these are a great, you know, growth opportunity for, you know, lactobacillus. And, you know, that's why, you know, malt is, a lot of people don't realize this, but malt is like really, really heavily contaminated with lactic acid bacteria. You know, it's much more than if you went out and bought barley seed, because the malting process, you know, is a nice, you know, nice brewing or growth medium. You know, sets up the nice conditions for the growth. Although black patent malt, they end up heating it enough that ends up being sterile, but like pale malts don't.
So any base malt probably.
Yeah. It's actually interesting. I read somewhere that, you know, in malting, they could need to continually aerate the water to keep, you know, cause the, barley seeds are living and, you know, they need oxygen to stay alive, but basically half of the, oxygen that gets used up in malting actually ends up being used by microorganisms that are growing in the water.
Huh. So there should be plenty on there.
Yeah. This should be, you know, should be nice and contaminated for you by the time you get it.
After your sacrification rest of your little mash, should you mix in the cool water to cool it down to a safer temperature before you put in the dry grain, the new grain, to inoculate it to make sure that you don't kill those bugs?
I've always mixed it up, the grain and the cool water, and then dumped it in. That'll happen pretty quickly because you'll add the stuff and you'll get right down to 120 mm-hmm. in no time. If you're worried about it, you could, you know, keep an extra handful of dry crushed grain aside, and when you're down to temperature, add that, just as an extra precaution. But, you know, usually, Lactobacillus is an organism that's pretty much everywhere. If you do the inoculate the sour mash with, you know, sort of a cold, you know, a little bit of mash, that's going to work almost every time.
Would any base malt work, or are there some that are better than others?
I don't know. I just use plain old two-row, whatever my homebrew shop was selling the times I did it. I don't know that anyone would be any better or worse than the other.
So after a couple of days, you open up your cooler. You make sure the temperature is right. You take the plastic off the top. You smell it. It smells wonderful. It's nice and sour. Now what? What do you do now?
Well, if it smells wonderful, you're in good shape. There's one, if I can just take a tangent here for a second, there's one thing to do if it doesn't smell good, and that's take a big spoon and scoop off the top layer, and then, smell it again. A lot of times, if there's a contamination in it, a lot of times it's in the top layer because it's, it might be an aerobic something, and you might have, not sealed the top of it against oxygen quite as well as you thought. So, yeah, don't immediately give up on a sour mash. The outside of it might, the top might smell bad, but in the center it might be good.
Hmm.
And then if you do get a, if you do open up and it just smells sour, cleanly sour, then all you do is, when you mash in your regular grain at the regular temperature, you just stir in your sour mash into your mash, like you would anything, and just let it go.
If you're worried about hitting your mash temperature properly, you might heat that little mash up to your rest that you're shooting for.
You can do that, or you can, I've always done it the easy way, just I start out by, I stir the sour mash in first into the dry grains, and then just add water, that's a little bit hotter than I normally would have used for the strike water, and just heat it up. But yeah, you can do that too. You can heat your sour mash up to the presumed mash temperature and then add it.
Now, what if you're an extract brewer? Are you out of luck?
Well, as an extract brewer, you obviously you're not doing a mash, so you wouldn't, need to do this for biological acidification. But if you wanted to make a sour beer, you certainly could make a sour mash, let it develop like that, and then you could just, pour the mash into a big strainer or colander and, collect the soured wort from it, and, you could add that to your boil. But, yeah, you wouldn't do it in the mash because you wouldn't have a mash. But,
right.
Yeah. So it's you can utilize the wort from a sour mash easily.
So it's kind of like doing a mini mash or a partial mash, only it's just a couple days longer process, essentially.
Right.
So is that it? That sounds pretty easy.
It's really easy. There's not much to it. The big things are just keeping oxygen away as best you can, and trying to maintain the temperature. And with the small volume of grain you've got, maintaining the temperature is usually the biggest problem. It really wants to drop. You can, if you're sort of really wanting to actively, intervene or whatever, you could take a couple times a day and, take your mash out, stir in some boiling water, or even dump it into a pot and heat it back up. and dump it into your cooler, but I think most people have done it more than a couple times, just sort of try to insulate their cooler as best they can, try to stick it somewhere hot and just sort of, you know, hope for the best.
And what's the critical temperature range that we're talking about?
Right around 120 is what you want. Over 130 and you start killing off some of the things you want. Although you also kill off some of the things you don't want. But 120 is a good range. That's the sort of optimum range for the lactic acid bacteria. And you assume that they're going to be relatively plentiful versus other stuff growing in the mash initially. And so if you get them right at that temperature where they'll grow well, you sort of assume or hope that they're going to take over the mash mostly and sort of competitively exclude almost everything else.
So around 120 Fahrenheit is close to 50 degrees Celsius for
right
for those who with a more sane temperature scale.
yeah.
Well, great. It's still a little warm. There may be time for me warm outside. It might be time for me to try this before the cold weather hits. There are also some other interesting articles in this this issue of Brew Your Own. There's your article on dark secrets of partial mashing, where you bring up some interesting points about the character of dark beers and some things that you want to look out for when you're doing a partial mash. Give us the 30,000 feet view of that article.
Yeah, the basic idea is that if you're doing an all-grain batch and you're doing a dark beer, you know especially a very dark one like a stout or a porter, is, you know, you'll have, roughly about 90% of the grains will be, you know, your pale malt, in some of those beers there's an adjunct like flaked barley, but, you know, it's pale grains. And then your color all comes from, you know, the darkly roasted grains. And in a full mash, you know, there's usually about 10% of that. And even at that 10%, a lot of times you need to adjust your water chemistry a little bit. You need to add some carbonates, either calcium carbonate or sodium bicarbonate to the water to, account for the acidity in the dark grains. Well, in a partial mash, you're faced with that only given the size of it, you know, you're going to have maybe 50% of your mash is dark grains. And so the potential is there, and it occurs that in a small mash with a lot of dark grains that the pH drops really low. Mm. And so you can take the usual step of adding carbonates to your water, but you'd really sort of need a pH meter to, you know, find out what the right balance of, carbonates in your water is to get the mash pH to the right level. And that's something that, you know, I don't think a lot of, people who are just, you know, stovetop brewers doing partial mashes, you know, they might not have a pH meter. And, you know, it's generally, you know, a simple way to brew and, you know, they may not want to complicate it that much. So there's sort of an end run around that, and that's that there are grains that you can mash or that you have to mash, but there are many grains that you can just steep. And basically all the dark grains fall into the category of grains that you can steep. So when you're doing a partial mash, just do a partial mash of either just the pale malt or the pale malt and a little crystal to make it like an amber mash, and then steep the dark grains separately. So you, in the steep, you know, the pH of the steep is going to be low, but that doesn't matter because you're not relying on the enzymes to do anything.
Right.
And then just combine them. And then you still end up with, you know, dark beers still benefit from having some carbonate added. But you can do that in the boil in this case, you know, of doing a partial mash beer is just, you know, wait till the boil or... in my article, I sort of advocated doing what I did in my test batches and just I figured out how much carbonate I would need and split half of it between the steep and the boil.
Ah. Then there's
so that's basically that's the gist of the article.
Then there's a wonderful article by an author that we've seen before in your magazine. Oh, it's me.
Oh, it's you. How did that happen?
Actually,
I thought we had specific mechanisms to keep you out of this mix.
Well, they failed miserably.
Yes.
Actually, I can't take credit for much of the article because most of it came from listener input. We took our Green Brewing Show comments, basically, and I compiled them into an article on Green Brewing. So if you submitted suggestions for Green Brewing for our episode on that topic, you may see yourself and brew your own.
There you are in print. Yep.
So
yeah, they were there were some good suggestions. And like a lot of or one of the nice things about the article, I think, is that it showed how you could not only brew in an environmentally friendly manner, but a lot of times, you know, by reducing the amount of things you're using, you're also saving yourself money, which is nice.
Sure. So no matter which side of the fence you come down on, as far as, you know, global warming and saving the planet and all that stuff, if you're cheap or frugal like me, it makes sense anyway.
Sure.
Well, great. Once again, I appreciate your time, Chris, and I know you've got to go batten down the hatches. So good luck riding out the storm.
Yeah, I'll have to brew a commemorative batch of beer if we actually get any weather here. But right now, we're just sort of waiting and seeing.
All right. Take care, Chris. Thanks a lot.
All right, James. Good talking to you.
Well, thanks again to Chris. You can read the articles about sour mashing, partial mashing dark beers, and how to brew more green in the October issue of Brew Your Own. You can get a free copy of BYO if you click on the banner ad on basicbrewing.com. And if you decide to subscribe after reading that issue, you'll be helping to support this podcast. We definitely appreciate everybody who's done that. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can check out our low-tech lagering and decoction mashing DVD on basicbrewing.com as well, where you can see Steve Wilkes do a single-step decoction mash, and you can follow me through a lager fermentation in the middle of summer where I don't use a dedicated chest freezer. There are also our original DVDs in Basic Brewing, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing. We walk you through the extract brewing process step-by-step from boiling to bottling. And in Basic Brewing, Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort. We got combo deals on our site if you want to save a few bucks. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. And we now have shirts of different colors. People seem to like the brown and the green. The guy at the shirt shop, he predicted black would be the big color. There you go. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Dark Shadows, The Beginning, Collection 1, and Toy Dance Party. That sounds like fun. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on the site next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we'll get a little hunk of that. And you won't have to pay any extra. What a deal. We appreciate your support. We also have an associate link to the Apple Store on the site as well. That's all until next week, everybody. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson, who is also in Austin and also didn't get blown away. Thank goodness. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.